Shall we get started?
Peter B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, May 19th, 2017. My special guest on today's podcast is John Kiriakou, who served 30 months in federal prison, a former CIA officer who knew about the torture program, didn't torture anybody, but as a whistleblower, he faced the wrath of Barack Obama and the retaliation that occurred after he made some what he thought were pretty innocent disclosures. John Kiriakou has published a new book, and it's called Doing Time Like a Spy. I've got a copy of it right here. And we've just completed an in-depth interview that I'll be releasing to my subscribers just after today's podcast. And John is going to be phoning in on the half hour. And he has agreed to take phone calls from you, my listeners and viewers. So get ready to call in. The phone number here at the studio is 415-455-0102. Maybe you want to write that down and have it available for you. That is 415-455-0102. Let's dive into the news. I'm starting with a report that Vox posted today. Headline, Democrats are falling for fake news about Russia. And I am gratified at this report because I think it's an important warning to people who are so eager to see Donald Trump removed from office, eager to see the Democrats as an effective political force in Washington and in Trump's America today. And, well, it's not that simple. Let's just be clear about that. And this report focuses on two sources of questionable, fact-free reporting that are pretty prevalent and widely circulated among Democrats and lefties today. It includes the work of Louise Mensch. She's an employee of Rupert Murdoch. Yes, Fox News. She runs some blogs, and she's a former member of the British Parliament. She's married to a guy named Peter Mensch, who is the manager of some hard rock bands. She's an attractive and interesting woman, but she has been reporting some things that have proven to be accurate and some things that remain unproven. And so if you look at the recent work of Louise Mensch, she's got, 283,000 followers on Twitter, and she is connected, at least in this article, with a former NSA spook named John Schindler, whom I don't know, and a Washington-area photographer named Claude Taylor. And between them, they have another 400,000 followers in social media. And we see a lot of these claims that originate with Louise Mensch. And somebody who got sucked in recently is a man who I generally respect. Ed Markey is the junior Democratic senator from the state of Massachusetts, and he had to apologize for spreading a false claim that a New York grand jury was investigating the Trump-Russia scandal, and his sources were Louise Mensch and the Palmer Report, which we'll get to in a moment. So one of the comments came from John Swain of the Guardian newspaper. A Markey aide says that the senator was referring to reports on Louise Mensch's blog and the Palmer Report. So this is a virus, or at least a bug, that is afflicting, including some, you know, many people, including some smart members of the United States Senate. And so, you know, a lot of this has to do with the fact that we're dealing in a fact-free environment in Washington. So much of the information that is treated as fact is coming from anonymous sources without any provable public documentation. And this creates a real information crisis in this country. And it is only stoked further by people who read information that confirms their bias and decide, well, it must be true. So Mensch did have the legitimate scoop that Carter Page was the subject of a FISA court proceeding, but she has gone on to report things that are simply speculative. For example, sources with links to the intelligence community claim that Trump, Mike Pence, the vice president, and Speaker Paul Ryan were all going to be arrested on racketeering charges. Well, we haven't seen that, and I don't even see a shred of speculation that supports that. Another, Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, is the designated survivor. And according to Louise Mensch, is likely to become president. I've seen speculative reporting about that, where they even suggest that, he would become president despite the fact that he's like third or fourth in line, according to the Constitution and the federal succession laws. Louise Mensch has recently suggested that Anthony Weiner was brought down as a part of a Russian plot. Well, Anthony Weiner pled guilty in federal court in New York today, and we'll get to that story a little bit later. But one that really irritates me, and a source that gets wide circulation on my Facebook newsfeed from people who I consider to be smart and well-informed, is this guy Bill Palmer. And anytime I see a story that is attributed to the Palmer Report, my bullshit detector goes into high gear. Now, Bill Palmer, I believe, came out of the David Brock Correct the Record media maw from the campaign last year. But he often takes a single tiny little factoid and spins it up with a dramatic headline that really amounts to clickbait for lefties and then leads to a real letdown when you actually get to the article and read what he has to say. But the Palmer Report got 400,000 visitors last week. This article at Vox says that that's more than the website of GQ magazine. I don't know what kind of a standard that is. A story that he wrote about a second Russia prostitute story linked to Trump was shared more than 41,000 times on Facebook. And another that alleged that Congressman Jason Chaffetz was paid off by Trump and Russia got about 29,000 shares. So I just want people to be careful and to recognize that no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, that we're dealing with a set of issues where there is no evidence. There is no public evidence. We are left to trust the CIA, the intelligence community, and I don't. When John Kiriakou joins us at the bottom of the hour, you're free to ask him about these issues and who he believes and the extent to which he thinks there is any credibility to the claims of Russian interference in our election, and in particular, the claim that appears to be evaporating that Russian operatives hacked the DNC servers and gave that information to WikiLeaks. So, as you know, I've been skeptical of that all along, and we are seeing that with the uneven reporting about the investigation into the murder of Seth Rich in Washington last July, that there is a clear alternative theory, and this is where we get into competing conspiracy theories, because I believe that Rachel Maddow has tried very hard to draw connections between Trump, his campaign officials, and Russia. And while the reporting has turned up some dastardly deeds and some dirty connections that Trump has with some really corrupt people, it doesn't amount to proof that they interfered in our election. And we have to remain skeptical. And I am very concerned when people, like I say, who are generally well-informed and who I know and respect, fall for things like the Palmer Report. Meanwhile, in Washington, uneven reactions from Democratic leaders about the situation with Trump and whether they should move to impeachment. The most cautious voice is Adam Schiff, the Southern California Democrat, who is the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee. And he said, "No one, in my view, ought to rush to embrace the most extraordinary remedy that involves the removal of the president from office." He said that Democrats want to be sure that their actions are not perceived as an effort to nullify the election by other means. Now, at the very same moment that he made that statement According to the New York Times, Congressman Al Green, the Democrat of Texas, was in the House of Representatives thundering, "The president must be impeached." Likewise, my old friend Maxine Waters, Democrat from Los Angeles, she's not on board with delaying impeachment. She said, "I know that there are those who are talking about, well, we're going to get ready for the next election," she said, mimicking her more cautious colleagues. "No, we can't wait that long. We don't need to wait that long. He will have destroyed the country by then." Over at Democracy for America, Charles Chamberlain issued a statement, "Congress needs to act now to impeach Trump." And we have J.B. Pritzker from the Hyatt Hotel ownership family. He is running for governor of Illinois. He publicly demanded that the House initiate proceedings against Trump. "We do not have the luxury of time to wait for months or years to determine whether the current president of the United States has committed high crimes and misdemeanors." But Bernie Sanders is cautious. He said, "What needs to happen is we have to go forward with an absolutely bipartisan investigation. The public must understand that this is not a Democratic issue." So the messages are pretty mixed. Where do you stand on impeachment? Dennis Kucinich, who ran for president in 2004 and 2008, served in Congress from Northeast Ohio. He is warning that this is all part of an effort by the deep state to take down Trump. And I think that this is a significant warning. I don't support Trump. I'd love to see him taken down. But if the price of that is empowering the murky forces of the deep state, the leakers in the intelligence and surveillance communities, who will face no charges like Chelsea Manning or even John Kiriakou, well, we have to be very cautious about ejecting Trump from the driver's seat and essentially allowing the intelligence/surveillance operatives, the top dogs there, to run our government. They already have too much influence, in my opinion. Kucinich, "The political process of the United States of America being under attack by intelligence agencies and individuals in those agencies." He said, "We're under attack from within. You have politicization of agencies that's resulting in leaks from anonymous unknown people, and the intention is to take down a president. Now, this is very dangerous to America. It constitutes a clear and present danger to our way of life. So we have to be asking, what's the motive of these people? Who's putting these leaks out? Why doesn't somebody come forward and make a charge and put their name and reputation behind it instead of attacking through the media and not substantiating their position?" Well, there is a lot of, I think, important wisdom in what Kucinich is telling us. In an op-ed in today's New York Times, a couple of specialists, one is a professor at Amherst, Stephen Simon, and another is a former National Security Council director named Jonathan Stevenson. They co-wrote an op-ed in today's New York Times. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. And they are responding to a strong article written by Jonathan Landay and another reporter published at Reuters yesterday, which says that Mike Flynn appears to have tabled, to just put a hold on a plan coming from the Obama administration during the transition. And in a meeting with Susan Rice, he apparently just said, don't proceed or, put a hold on any plans to provide arms to the Syrian Kurdish fighters. And this, of course, is in conflict with the wishes of the state of Turkey. Mike Flynn, we now know, got $600,000 to lobby for Turkey. And these authors of this op-ed want us to believe that Mike Flynn did not, in fact, materially affect policy. And I think that they're speculating just like anybody else is. But in my view, Mike Flynn most likely is culpable for this impact on our foreign policy. And I base that on the pattern of his behavior. We know from former CIA Director Jim Woolsey that back in September, he attended a meeting with Mike Flynn where Flynn was openly conspiring about ways to kidnap kidnapped the Turkish imam Fethullah Gulen, who is in exile in Pennsylvania. So I have to say that the evidence tilts in favor of the speculation that Flynn did influence American foreign policy on behalf of his paymasters who are tied to Turkey. So take a look at that op-ed and see what you think. Meanwhile, the latest revelations from the New York Times about James Comey's contemporaneous notes of his meetings and conversations with Donald Trump has gone into a new chapter, and they actually name an individual who I speculate was the source, the unnamed source, of the original report about the Comey memos. So in another story by Michael S. Schmidt, we are told that President Trump called James Comey weeks after he took office and asked him when federal authorities were going to put out word that Trump was not personally under investigation. And Comey tried to use that conversation to school Trump on the fact that this conversation they were having was inappropriate and violated policies. He then told a friend who is identified as Benjamin Wittes, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the editor-in-chief of the Lawfare blog. Again, I'm speculating, but Wittes appears to be the source for all the information on the Comey memos about Trump. So he told Wittes that he thought he had drawn the line, and that he also revealed that the following day, Reince Priebus, the White House chief of staff, called over to Comey. And this is where we believe we might have entered the phase of a cover-up, a criminal cover-up, and the investigation that has been tasked to Robert Mueller, the former FBI chief, is now expected to delve into that, according to today's Washington Post. Comey described all of his contacts with the president and the White House, including the phone call, in the detailed memos, and the White House press secretary said in a statement on Thursday that the sworn testimony of Comey and the FBI's now acting director, Andrew McCabe, make clear that there was never any attempt to interfere in this investigation. Now, it is fair, and I want to note that I do listen to right-wing radio shows, and yesterday I caught up with this guy, Mark Levin, and he did make a strong case that we don't know why Comey, on May 3rd, his last visit to Capitol Hill, denied that there was any effort to impede the investigation by the Justice Department, but failed to mention that the White House was trying to impede the investigation, both through Trump and the overtures of Reince Priebus. So there's going to be more of this. In the next week or so, we're going to see if Comey will testify in public on Capitol Hill for the Senate and or the House. When we see the actual contemporaneous notes that he took about his conversations and meetings with Trump is anybody's guess, but we'll have to see. One of the things that may get in the way is the appointment of Robert Mueller as the special counsel. Before we get to him, there is breaking news today that through notes that were issued by the White House about the meeting with the Sergeys, Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, Sergey Kaslyev, or something like that, who is the Russian ambassador to Washington. We don't have the notes that Putin promised. These are a document from note takers who were in the Oval Office during this meeting, and this has been released and not denied by the White House, and what it says is that he told the Russians that the FBI director was fired and that that relieved great pressure on Trump. Quote, I just fired the head of the FBI. He was crazy. A real nut job, Trump told the Russians. I faced great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off. And by the way, he added, I'm not under investigation. So take that for what it's worth. Now, the appointment of Bob Mueller, which I sharply criticized yesterday, and I want to point out that Sane Progressive and a couple of other online outlets have offered criticism of Mueller and his appointment. My friend Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst, has republished an article that he wrote about Mueller a couple of years ago. But by and large, the corporate media and the Beltway gang are just slobbering, gushing over the appointment of Bob Mueller. And his appointment, I think, is likely to take the story out of the news. It's going to stifle the investigations, bad as they are, that have been underway in the House and the Senate Intelligence Committees. And we may not hear a peep from Bob Mueller for a year or two. So it may have the effect of putting this investigation, not to sleep, but out of the reach of the public and the media. So we'll be watching that carefully, but my expectation is that that's one of the silver linings for Trump in the appointment of the special counsel. Now, it's interesting that the White House and Trump himself have issued these trial balloons. Joe Lieberman, the former senator from Connecticut, presidential candidate in 08, didn't last long, vice presidential candidate with Al Gore in 2000, a guy who sold out the Democratic Party. He was never a progressive. And he is so staunchly aligned with the state of Israel that it defines some of his hardline positions and his eagerness for war. So what's interesting to me is that Lieberman is being slammed by his former Democratic colleagues on Capitol Hill, some of whom are willing to be quoted, like Claire McCaskill, the Democratic senator from Missouri. I don't think there's going to be much excitement about Joe from our side. Not because we don't respect Joe Lieberman, but we need a law enforcement professional, not someone who's run for office before. We don't need anyone who's put on a red shirt or a blue shirt, who's campaigned for president. So, by the way, he ran in 2004. I think I said 2008. Also, we've got Joe Manchin, who the conservadem from West Virginia, who said that he is not lobbying for Joe Lieberman. Sherrod Brown is very willing to be quoted on this. He said that he fumed about Lieberman's efforts to undercut Medicare benefits and Obamacare, his closeness to Trump. He works for the law firm that represents Trump. And after a monologue on Lieberman's faults, Brown ended by telling a reporter, "That's all on the record." If you're on Facebook, you're watching the Peter B. Collins podcast, as I recorded here on Friday. And in just about 6 or 7 minutes, we're going to be joined by John Kiriakou. He's got a new book out called, Doing Time Like a Spy. It's about his experience in federal prison. And he really offered some powerful comments. I've been covering prison issues here in California for a long time. I learned a few new things. And in this excerpt from my conversation, my in-depth interview with John Kiriakou, which will be released later this afternoon, he had this to say about the incarceration mania in the United States today.
Peter, before I got in trouble, I didn't give 5 seconds of thought to the justice system, or certainly to the prison system. Not 5 seconds of thought. And then living through it made me realize what a broken system we have. You know, I throw out this statistic all the time because it's true and it's shocking, and that is that the United States has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. We have more people incarcerated per capita than the Russians, the Chinese, even the Iranians. That, to me, is a problem. When there's no rehabilitation and no education, that's a problem. When mental health is treated as a disciplinary problem, that's a problem. When one out of every four black men in America is either in prison or jail or on probation or parole, that's a problem. And we don't see it as a problem. We have an attorney general now who wants to reimpose mandatory minimum sentences on for drug crimes. Well, that's what got us to this point. So that was something that really opened my eyes. Another thing, too, is, you know, you really get to see what happens in a community where everybody's poor, where people don't have an educational background or a foundation in even basic education, where they don't have job skills. They end up in prison. And I overheard a conversation one time that was just, it was just so stunning to me. I don't think I'll ever forget it. There were these three African-American guys playing cards in the TV room. It was middle of the day. All the TVs were on. Most people were at work or outside, so the place was empty, and these guys were playing cards. And one of them just kind of looked around and said, "You know, we get 3 square meals a day. We get a warm bed. We get clothes. We got TV. We can play cards. We get medical care. If we had pussy, this place would be paradise.
That's John Kiriakou from my in-depth interview. It's released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com and most of our outlets. And it's made possible by people like you who subscribe to my podcast, including Grant Gibson in Portland, Cheryl Fleming, Terry Paris in the People's Republic of Berkeley, and Mark Brodsky in Northern Illinois. They're all longtime supporters of this podcast, and I hope you'll join them. I need your help to keep it all going. Just come over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, click on Become a Subscriber, and it takes you to the sign-up page where you can make a choice about the level of support that's comfortable for you. As mentioned, John Kiriakou is going to call in here in just a few minutes. I'll be putting him on the air here on the podcast and on Facebook, and you can call in and talk to him. The phone number is 415-455-0102, 415-455-0102. Couple of quickies. As I mentioned, Anthony Weiner has entered a guilty plea in federal court in Manhattan today. He will have to register as a sex offender, and he may be sentenced to prison time for sexting with a minor. Louise Mensch is suggesting that was a Russian plot. I'm sorry. The fact pattern doesn't support that. The greatest success that Trump claims is passing through the House of Representatives, the repeal and so-called replacement of Obamacare, but that bill has not even been sent to the Senate. And the reason is that they're waiting for the scoring from the Congressional Budget Office to find out exactly what the cost will be and to learn if that is going to permit the Senate to use the reconciliation rules to pass this bad piece of legislation. And that ignores the clear message from the Senate members of both parties that they're not going to use the House bill as a model. They're going to rewrite it or write their own bill. So it's interesting to see that it is stuck so far. And I've got a few other stories here, but one that I want to jump to is about my in-depth interview earlier this week with Peter Van Buren. And Peter, of course, is the State Department whistleblower who's published a powerful new novel, which is called Hooper's War. And we released an in-depth interview with Van Buren earlier this week. I'm also directing you to a very powerful column that he wrote for Tom Dispatch yesterday that deals with the issue of moral injury. And in it, Peter Van Buren speculates that Chelsea Manning reacted to the moral injury that she experienced in Iraq and as someone who had access to a great deal of intelligence. And so it's a really powerful, I think, expression. And it is about something we really haven't talked much about before, the kind of subconscious damage that occurs to people who are in war zones, who participate in combat, and even those who participate in the remote-control drone warfare that America is using today. So I want to encourage you to listen to the interview with Peter Van Buren. It's available for subscribers right now at peterbcollins.com, and it'll be unrestricted in about 10 days so that everyone can hear it. And finally, I want to note that Julian Assange has received some relief. He can't walk out of the Embassy of Ecuador in London yet. But the government of Sweden has announced that they are terminating their 7-year-old sex crimes investigation into Assange. And unless the British have an American extradition order, it is likely that they may let him go with a slap on the wrist. He is still considered subject to arrest under an older warrant from Britain for failing to surrender. But the authorities acknowledge that that is a much more minor charge than the sex-related charges that were coming from Sweden. So I think that's an interesting development, and it's been a kind of good week for whistleblowers as Chelsea Manning was released from Leavenworth. I've got John Kiriakou on the line. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon. Happy to be back.
Glad to have you with me here on the live Facebook exchange here. And this, of course, is being recorded. This podcast will be released to my regular subscribers and listeners as soon as we complete it. And I also have referenced, John, that you and I did an almost hour-long interview yesterday that I'm releasing to subscribers today, where you talk at length about your experiences at the Loretta Prison in Pennsylvania and your new book called Doing Time Like a Spy. And before we dive into that, I wanted to get your comments on Chelsea and on Julian and the developments in their stories this week.
Oh, yeah. Good news on both fronts. Better news for Chelsea than Julian, though, because we don't really know what Julian ought to expect. I think the rumors that he either has been secretly indicted in the Eastern District of Virginia or that a grand jury is secretly meeting in the Eastern District of Virginia ought to be taken seriously. And so in the event that he decides to finally leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London, I'm not sure he can just walk out, deal with this minor issue for him in Britain, and then just be free to go. I suspect that there's going to be some kind of legal action by the United States, by the Justice Department, to bring him to trial here in the U.S., which I think is just dreadful.
Well,
I add something to that, too?
Oh, sure.
I was in Germany last week meeting with a lot of transparency activists and whistleblower activists. There were a couple of important or prominent WikiLeaks supporters, and everybody raised the same point that we really aren't talking about here in the United States, and that is that if Julian is brought to the U.S. to face trial on an espionage charge, he is going to be able to request in a CIPA hearing, a Classified Information Protection Act hearing, the release of really as many as millions of classified documents that he's going to need in order to protect himself mm-hmm. and to defend himself. So there's going to have to be a decision made between the Justice Department and the CIA about whether or not they really want to risk the release of potentially millions more pages of classified information just for a shot at prosecuting him.
And the other complication from the government's point of view that apparently is what prevented the Obama administration from more aggressively pursuing Assange is that an indictment and trial for him would also implicate the media outlets that have published WikiLeaks product. And
that's right.
That could become a First Amendment crisis.
And I think that's really the likeliest avenue of defense for him. The guy's a journalist. He's been saying from the very beginning that he's a journalist. This is a First Amendment issue, and it's something that, you know, I can't think of an example any time earlier in American history where there's been such a direct frontal assault on freedom of the press as we're looking at here.
And Mike Pompeo, the latest boss of your old shop, the CIA, has made some troubling comments, essentially saying that Assange, you know, doesn't qualify for the First Amendment because he's not an American, and that he somehow has used the equities of our First Amendment against the government. And I think that's a pretty perverse defense of the excessive secrecy.
Yeah, perverse and unconstitutional. It's one thing for us to say, well, Mike Pompeo's not an attorney, but any school child knows that the Constitution guarantees the right to freedom of speech for everybody. It doesn't say in the Constitution you have to be an American citizen to have a freedom of speech. So Pompeo's just making a fool of himself when he says things like that. Although Pompeo's the same guy who also said in 2015 that he would like to see Ed Snowden return to the United States so that he can hang from a tree until he's dead.
Yeah. Yeah, lovely people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Real champions of the Constitution.
And here's my daydream fantasy, John. We get like two dozen Uber cars, all convertibles, with extra padding in the back seat, and they drive by the Ecuadorian embassy, and Julian just jumps off that balcony into one of them.
And, you know, to tell you the truth, the British people are tired of this nonsense, too. This has cost them millions and millions of dollars to have this ridiculously large police force surrounding the Ecuadorian embassy just in case one of these days Julian decides to walk out. This is an utter waste of the British taxpayers' money.
Absolutely. Now, I thought it was a waste of taxpayer money to prosecute John Kiriakou and put him in a federal pen. And this, of course, was another Obama payback for alleged crimes that occurred under the Bush administration. And that war on whistleblowers had to come as a kind of surprise to you. And, John, I brought my special Ai Weiwei cap. It is a red cap, and initially some people think I'm a Trump supporter just because it's red. It doesn't say "Make America Great." It has an interesting symbol on the front of it here, and this is my souvenir from the Alcatraz art exhibit that Ai Weiwei put on a few years ago. And one of the three elements of it was a large room with this tapestry of Legos that was displayed on the floor. And it included Ai Weiwei's renderings of over 100 worldwide political prisoners. And John Kiriakou was among those. And I'd like you to share with our listeners, you gave me a great report on it in the in-depth interview that we're releasing today, but we have other people joining us here on Facebook today, so tell us briefly about what happened in Berlin last weekend.
Right. I mentioned a few minutes ago that I was in Berlin last week for a series of conferences and events on government transparency and national security whistleblowing, and I'm also on the board of directors of the Courage Foundation, which is a Berlin-based nonprofit that does whistleblower support. So we had our first ever board meeting last Saturday, and I was going to go to the airport from the meeting, so I'm lugging my suitcase. I had never been in this neighborhood of Berlin before, so I'm kind of confused. I come out of the subway, I'm looking around, and there's a Chinese man walking toward me, and he just says, "Hello, John Kiriakou." And I looked at him like, how in the world does this man know who I am? And so I'm just staring at him, and he says to me very softly, "I am Ai Weiwei." And I said, "Oh, my goodness." I said, "Weiwei, how are you?" And I said, "Wow, I've always wanted to thank you for the honor that you showed me by including me in your wonderful show at Alcatraz." And so we stood there and chatted for a little while, and he invited me back to his studio. He was just out for a walk. It was just this random thing where we bumped into each other. And so I went over to his studio after the board meeting. It's quite an enormous complex. It's a former brewery, and much of it's underground, but with, you know, 30-foot-high ceilings. And he has these monumental works of art in different stages of completion. But he couldn't have been any more generous and friendly, and I thanked him for paying attention to my case. There were only three Americans in that show. It was Ed Snowden, Martin Luther King, and me. And yeah. I don't deserve to be included in that group, but there I was. He even gave me an iPhone case with my Lego portrait on it, and told me that the entire show is going to be rebuilt and shown at the Smithsonian's Hirshhorn Gallery starting around July 4th in Washington, so I'm excited to go see it there.
Oh, I always go to the Hirshhorn when I'm in Washington.
So it's my favorite art museum in Washington, and it's one of the most overlooked.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's exciting news. I didn't know about that. So I want to open up the phone lines, and John, we're still feeling our way along here with the Facebook Live.
Sure.
But I want to open up the phone lines and see if people would like to add a comment or ask a question for John Kiriakou. The number to call in on is 415-455-0102. I've got lines available now, 415-455-0102. And I do have a question that was submitted by email. John, about a third of my listeners are outside of the United States, and one is a gentleman named Olivier de Merleau, who lives in Switzerland, and he is a very sharp observer of American politics, and he picked up a blog post that was critical of you related to the case of Abu Zubaydah. Now, I want to note that you and my pal, I've interviewed Joseph Hickman three times over the years, you have co-authored a new book about Abu Zubaydah. And the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah was a central issue to to the retaliation that was visited upon you and led to your prison sentence. So Olivier is asking about what is described as an offhand remark that you made. And let me read a quote here.
Mm-hmm.
He says, the discussion went into the recent conviction of John Kiriakou. And by the way, this is a blogger who's talking to Lee Hamilton, the former Indiana congressman who was co-chair of the 9/11 Commission. So the discussion went into the recent conviction of Kiriakou, the CIA's chief of counter-terrorist operations in Pakistan after 9/11, who was originally said to be responsible for the capture and initial interrogations of Zubaydah. Interestingly, Kiriakou's story has evolved much like that of the official account concerning Zubaydah. According to people who would know with regard to Zubaydah, Kiriakou now rather offhandedly admits that he basically made it all up. Oh. So explain a little bit, and I'm looking forward to your book because I'm sure you'll go into much more detail. What is it that they're accusing you of making up or admitting that you made up?
Well, that's preposterous. I never said any such thing. But I think I know what they're talking about. What I said in the original ABC News interview in December 2007 was that there were two separate issues here. One, related to the torture of Abu Zubaydah. One, was torture moral and ethical? And I said no. And I said that it was never moral and ethical. Two, the second question was, did the torture of Abu Zubaydah work? And the CIA said that it did. They were reporting back from the secret site that Abu Zubaydah had cracked. He had provided actionable intelligence that had saved American lives. So I said, while this program was loathsome, the CIA is telling us that it worked. Well, that turned out to be untrue, not because I made it up, but because the reporting coming in from the field was being written by James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, the two contract psychologists who created the torture program for the CIA, and they were lying from the field because that was the only way to justify the $81 million that the CIA had paid them for their services. So they were attributing information that Abu Zubaydah had given to the torture or the enhanced interrogation techniques, when in fact Abu Zubaydah had given that information weeks or months earlier to FBI agent Ali Soufan.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was on ABC for that initial interview, the information that I had received from the CIA was faulty, and we didn't even know that until the CIA Inspector General report was released in April of 2009, and then finally when the Senate torture report was released. But to say that I made it up, or even that I said that I had made it up, is ludicrous.
All right. And I want to note, I'm going to link to a piece published at Alternate this week, co-authored by Joe Hickman with Ken Klippenstein, which adds some new information about the torture regime that was visited upon Abu Zubaydah and some information that has not previously been known. It also does focus a little bit on Mitchell and Jessen. And you pointed out that they earned, their firm did, $81 million for devising a torture program. And they actively participated, either in directing or, were hands-on in some of these torture sessions.
They were hands-on. And if you look at the Senate torture report, and especially the footnotes in the Senate torture report, you can see that really from the get-go, when they first started waterboarding Abu Zubaydah, it was so traumatic that his heart stopped and he had to be resuscitated. He had convulsions and seizures. I mean, this was real torture. There's just no way to get around that.
And as you look back, Abu Zubaydah is considered a forever prisoner.
Yes.
He will never be charged, and he will not likely never be released. Is not that a permanent stain on the alleged rule of law embraced by the United States?
Absolutely, yes. I feel very strongly about this. We are supposed to be a country of laws. We're supposed to be a country that has a constitution that's the envy of the world. And our constitution says that whether we like a man's politics or not, he has the same constitutional protections that you and I have. And those protections include a right to face his accusers in a court of law. Abu Zubaydah has never been charged with a crime. If he is the monster that the Bush and Obama administrations have told us that he is, then prove it in a court of law and punish him accordingly. If he's not, the only thing to do, as far as I'm concerned, in order to guarantee our respect for the Constitution, is to let him go.
Yeah. Let's take a phone call here at 415-455-0102. Hello, caller. Who's this?
Hi, this is Kyle, and I've interviewed John previously. It's been a great privilege and pleasure for Gonzo today. I wonder if John could talk a little bit about the current state of torture as he understands it.
Okay, be specific, Kyle. Are you referring to the U.S. use of torture in the current?
I certainly am.
Okay.
He's in a position to comment on the current situation. Now, it's my understanding that Obama allegedly cut all of that off. Mm-hmm. However, no pun intended. I'm wondering if it's John's understanding that that really did happen.
All right.
And what the Trump administration policy is.
All right. Go ahead, John. John? Hello, John. Do we still have you? Oh, boy. Kyle, you hold on here, okay?
Holding on.
All right. And let's see what happened to John over here. John's on line 4. And it's like his call just went silent. Let's see. I'll hang up on this line, and let's see if John calls right back. If not, I've got his number here, and I'll see if I can get him. I do think it's a good question, Kyle, because we heard Bush lie when he said the U.S. doesn't torture. His fingers were crossed,
right,
and maybe other things. And then we heard Obama, you know, say that there would be no torture on his watch. But we know that some people were renditioned, kidnapped, and taken into custody while Obama was president. And it does remain an open question about whether some torture was used. And, of course, Trump has bragged about how he believes in waterboarding and torture. And so it is a good question. So hold on a second here. I'm going to try to call John back on his cell phone here. Uh-oh. Where'd my dial tone go? That's very interesting. I'm having some sort of telephone issues. John, is that you?
Hey, yeah, I heard you say, let's take a call, and then the phone went dead.
Well, I'm sorry. Kyle called in, and he has interviewed you before, and his question is the United States still torturing people, to your knowledge, or did Obama's rejection of it actually take hold?
You know, that is a great question. And I'm not sure that any of us really knows what the answer is.
Right.
I want to, in my heart, believe President Obama when he said that with his executive order of January 2009, the torture program literally came to a halt. With that said, nobody's ever said anything about extraordinary renditions. So while it's probably true that we're not torturing prisoners, I think we also very probably send them to third countries to be tortured all the time as a matter of course. Nobody's ever said anything about that having changed.
Well, we have one known case of rendition. It was some young people who were picked up in al-Shabaab territory. I don't remember whether it was Tanzania or a neighboring country. And they were subject to the torture taxi. We don't know if they were sent someplace to be tortured, but there is at least that sketchy reporting that indicates that rendition was not completely eliminated during the Obama presidency.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It certainly was not. It was not ended or even limited during the Obama presidency. When I was in Germany last week, I had occasion to meet at the German parliament with several parliamentarians, and then I had lunch the next day with the National Security Advisor at his invitation. And they all had the same questions, and these questions really were all about rendition. And they wanted to ensure, they wanted me to tell them, like I have fresh new information, which I don't, that renditions are not taking place from German soil or through Germany. And I said I really didn't know.
And are they still concerned about the Al-Masri case? He was the, I think, a German national who we picked up in Macedonia and dropped off in Macedonia in the middle of the night after the error was identified.
That's one of the saddest stories of the so-called war on terror. Here's a guy named Khaled Al-Masri, and the name Al-Masri just means the Egyptian. So it's a very common name. There are millions and millions of Egyptians, and thousands of them are named Al-Masri. So this poor guy has a fight with his wife one night and decides that he needs a break. So he gets on a bus in Munich, and he decides to go to Macedonia to visit his brother. Well, one of our sister agencies picks up information, I'll just call it information, that somebody named Khaled Al-Masri is on a bus going to Macedonia, and this happened at the same time that the CIA also received information that somebody with a similar name was on his way to Albania to blow up the American embassy there. So the CIA asks the Macedonians to stop the bus and pick up Khaled Al-Masri. The guy's a greengrocer, right? He had just a little vegetable shop. He had no connection to terrorism, but his name was similar to the nom de guerre of a terrorist or possible terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
So the Macedonians stop the bus, they take him off the bus, they put him under arrest, and they turn him over to the United States. Well, the United States, you know, we really didn't know anything about him other than he's going to go blow up the American embassy, and they wanted to squeeze the guy, and so they turn him over to the government of Egypt. And he undergoes relentless and merciless torture for something like 18 months. And then finally the Egyptians come back to us and say, hey, listen, this is the wrong guy. But what happened to Khaled Al-Masri before the Egyptians finally released him back to Germany is that he was a normal guy when he went in. And when he came out, he had a very long, bushy beard. He was clutching the Quran. And he vowed to fight the United States for the rest of his life. Now, the Germans ended up paying him a multi-million dollar settlement. But the U.S. has a policy of never apologizing and never paying a settlement. It's not just Khaled Al-Masri we did this to.
Yeah.
We did this to Maher Arar, a Canadian national, and to others around the world. So here this poor guy, Khaled Al-Masri, now has severe PTSD, I'm told. He has difficulty leaving his home because he has agoraphobia now because of his imprisonment, and he's been radicalized, and he's radicalized because of us.
And John, you know, we've heard so much about former Guantanamo prisoners who were released and quote unquote returned to the battlefield, and no one ever pauses to think that we caused that they were probably not terrorism prone before we locked them up and tortured them.
Right.
But they certainly were afterward. And it's always treated as, well, you know, you can't let anybody go because we might have radicalized them. And that's just such a pathetic circular argument.
It's awful. Awful, yeah. And it's just wrong.
Kyle, did you have another question?
Well, listening to what you said earlier about the Democrats, I'm just wondering if you and John agree with me that that somehow we've got to turn the Democratic Party around, assuming it can be saved. That's a big assumption.
Mm-hmm.
To some sort of sanity. I mean, are there any sane Democrats left? Who would you hold up as somebody we can? I mean, with Kucinich, you know, I miss Kucinich as an actual seated member of the House of Representatives. Is there anybody on that level now in the Democratic Party?
John, you go first.
That's a great question. Not many. Certainly none with national name recognition, really. I'll tell you who I've really come to like and respect is Maxine Waters.
Mm-hmm.
And but I don't think she's even really interested in a national position. I generally like Elizabeth Warren, but, you know, she's just plain wrong on some foreign policy issues.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Wrong.
She's me too on Israel.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I spoke with Dennis Kucinich a couple of days ago, and I actually said that to him. I said, Dennis, we so miss you in Congress. And he laughed, and he said, yeah, I kind of miss me in Congress, too.
All right, Kyle, thank you for your call.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I appreciate you checking in today. And, John, as we wrap up, I released your interview and another whistleblower who is a mutual friend, Peter Van Buren, earlier this week about his new novel called Hooper's War.
Mm-hmm.
And he has started a conversation that I think is really important about moral injury. And he distinguishes it from PTSD. And moral injury is a kind of deeper sense of guilt and responsibility for the carnage that people have been exposed to or feel responsible for. And I wanted to get your comment on this whole idea of moral injury and the extent to which it afflicts average Americans. Because, you know, we've now been in a perpetual war situation for over 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that it does affect our daily consciousness. And I'm not going woo-woo here on you. I'm just talking in a very general way that when we wake up and we know that we've droned some innocent people in Yemen and we got Jared Kushner just engineering a $110 billion arms deal for the Saudis to keep the shooting gallery in Yemen active and, you know, more innocent people will be killed. I believe that it affects us in ways that we really are not aware of.
I think you're right, and I wouldn't confine it just to our foreign policy or to our intelligence policy. Look at what's happening across the country in reaction to the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, I think that there's a sense of moral injury there, too, as well. Why is it okay to just kill black people? And we saw it in Oklahoma again, what was it, yesterday or the day before, where an unarmed black man was killed by a white police officer, and the white police officer was acquitted yet again. It just seems to be this national theme that we have, and we're unwilling to talk about it. But yeah, I think there is a sense of moral injury, at least among people who, you know, are on our side of the political spectrum. With that said, there aren't enough of us that experience this moral injury because we've been at war for 16 years, as you said a moment ago, and there just doesn't seem to be any end in sight. Where's the outrage? Why aren't we in the streets protesting this?
Well, it's another reason to miss Denis Kucinich. He was a strong voice against war, and he even stuck his neck out and proposed a Department of Peace, which led to a lot of derisive comments. But for God's sake, we sure need to address that. And you know, both parties are now deeply ingrained and invested in future wars. The Democrats, with the hysteria over Russia, I think are inviting a new, not just a Cold War, but actual armed conflict.
Yeah, we're in a permanent wartime economy right now. We've transitioned to the point where we have to stay at war all the time, or we'll go into recession. And shame on us for allowing that to happen.
Yeah. Well, John, I really appreciate you joining me here today for our Facebook Live feed. I want to recommend your new book called Doing Time Like a Spy, How the CIA Taught Me to Survive and Thrive in Prison. And I'm looking forward to talking with you and also Joe Hickman when your book about Abu Zubaydah is published next month.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
John Kiriakou, wrapping up the Peter B. Collins podcast and live video feed on Facebook today. Here comes Roy Rogers to help us exit. I always appreciate your comments. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails. Smiling under